Thank you very much. So today I would like to report on the work of a working group, multi-state working group. We've been meeting over the past 5 years to consider this very extensive and complicated topic. You can find us under the name of Southern Coordinating Committee number 83. On the other hand, we have decided to not to continue in this format at least. We had a lot of interest from soil scientists, but the hope had really been to attract some of the plant physiologists and even medical professionals, or at least from the animal health professionals, and that really didn't happen. So it was we all love to talk about interdisciplinary work, but the reality is that finding venues where we can all get together has been extremely challenging. But nevertheless, I'm hopeful that we can continue so. We do have a review paper that we've been working on together that we hope to publish shortly. So to just give you a brief overview, and thanks to Eric for really introducing this topic in the biggest sense, because I'm really going to focus now on the debate that's occurred within the organic farming movement, and try and narrow that down to specific mechanisms that we may be able to trace there. So first of all, you know, as Eric said, this is an ancient debate, but one that was perhaps popularized in our time by the founders of the organic movement. This is certainly not a complete list of them. This is some of them. And they really popularized this idea that if we feed the soil and really work hard to produce healthy soils, there's going to be a relationship between plant health and human health that results. But again, this has been very much conceptual with not a lot of science behind it. So organic farming, though, really by necessity, does have a focus on farming soil organic matter and working with soil organic matter. There's a large focus on using organic amendments, diverse crop rotations and cover crops, and these are practices that we know do increase available soil organic matter, which provides the fuel for the soil biological processes and the soil food web, which also improves soil physical properties, increases the chemical properties of the soil, and acts as a slow-release fertilizer for our crops. So perhaps we can say that while this is not the sole domain of organic farmers are by necessity constrained to focus on this area, perhaps more so than farmers as a whole. Now, I'd really like to mention the work of John Doran. This is the classic soil quality health definition, and I must say that the more I work with this definition, the more I come to appreciate it. It certainly is broad. On the other hand, it encompasses this whole problem topic that we're talking about today, and also illustrates that what we know and what, you know, the areas which we know a little bit less about. I think nobody in this room would question that soils are highly unique and they function in very unique ways within the ecosystems that they were formed. And that there's also linkages, very well-known linkages, between soil health or quality, biological productivity, and environmental quality. And now, the final point, though, that whether soil health promotes plant health and animal and human health, that has really been the much more controversial, but also very a topic of much public interest. And that's the area that I'm going to focus on today in this talk. So just also to briefly mention that soil quality and health are used interchangeably in the literature. I think there's definitely a trend today to using the term soil health instead of soil quality, but they are used interchangeably, and I will use them that way in this talk. There are many out there who define soil health as specifically referring to the biological aspects of, of soil health, but they really are all interlinked. You know, soil biological properties influence chemical and physical properties, and so I'm a strong proponent that we, like what John Doran said, that we need to measure all three indicators in all three in order to get a complete picture. So, to also quote an early paper by Dr. Doran, he really classified the soil human health effects into three main groups. There's these toxic effects that Eric talked about this morning, radioactive or chemical contamination, and this could be man-made or naturally occurring, right? And then we have and biological contamination as well, the pathogens, and hookworm is a classic example of that, I think. But then there's this whole field of nutrient deficiencies and excesses. I think there's no doubt today that there are clear linkages between soil productivity or even fertilizer use and soil productivity and human health. If we don't have productive crops, we don't have healthy societies. But whether or not there's a positive direct relationship between healthy soils and healthy plants and healthy people has been much harder to really quantify. And that's what I'd like to focus on today, just with some very brief examples. So the linkages that I've chosen to highlight in this talk are the idea that there might be a relationship between nutrient-dense soils and nutrient-dense foods. It's a highly popular topic in the news and public consciousness today. But what is the evidence for this idea? Do we really know? There's also a lot of exciting new work on the effects of biological communities, the soil rhizosphere communities, and plant defense compounds, as well as the effects of soil fertility on plant biochemistry. And then finally, I'd just like to talk on this idea of what do we know about the possible relationships between nutrient-dense foods, plant defense compounds or secondary compounds, and human health. So there's a large body of well-known work on the relationship between management and nutrient density in foods. And when I say nutrient density, I mean the mineral elements, the macro and trace elements. And this is really reviewed extensively in Advances in Agronomy in the early 1980s, that when you stimulate plant growth with irrigation and fertilizers, plants grow faster, and in many cases then they will have a lower mineral nutrient content. More recently, perhaps in the last 10 years, there's been increasing interest in this idea that selective breeding itself might be influencing the nutritional content of foods. And there's a number of studies that suggest this in a wide number of crops. Some of them are listed here. Interestingly, potato is not one of those. However, Murphy et al. Published a paper in 2008 where they looked at nutrient concentrations in heirloom and modern cultivars of soft white wheats and hard red winter wheats, and they found a decline over time in the soft white wheats, but not the bread wheats. And this suggested to them, because this was all grown on the same soil type, the same soil, that this was a genetic dilution effect and not a soil nutrient density effect. However, I must say that there are actually very few studies that are really designed to look at this. This is just some data from a recent paper illustrating some of these trends. On the left-hand side, you have concentration of trace elements on the y-axis and yield in kilograms on the x-axis. You can see the decrease in iron and zinc with yield, and on the right-hand panel, similar, we have concentration of trace elements on the y-axis, and variety release date on the x-axis. I apologize, the little label's covering that up. I had to redo these so you could read them. So what about this question of secondary compounds and plant defense? Well, again, this is not a new idea. There's a lot of literature looking at the effects of plant growth-promoting rhizobacteria on plant defense compounds, systemic-induced resistance. And this more recently has really become known as the plant microbiome, right? That there's this intimate relationships, back and forth communication, chemical communication, if you will, between the rhizosphere organisms and the plant genetic responses. And multiple papers that show that these organisms stimulate, or the plants, you know, the plants secrete compounds into the rhizosphere, which in turn attract certain organisms to the rhizosphere or stimulate certain organisms in the rhizosphere that then stimulate root development, promote drought tolerance, reduce attractiveness to herbivores, suppress plant pathogens. And all of this, you know, together increases secondary compound production, which may or may not have a positive effect on the, you know, the consumers of these foods. This is just a recent paper, some data to illustrate this effect. What these authors did was to take a number of different food crops, and I don't list them all here because, again, there were too many. But on the y-axis, you have total phenolic compound concentration, and on the x-axis, you see the response of inoculation with Bacillus lentimorbus to production of these secondary compounds. So you have the fresh plant and the... they also looked at different processing methods. But clearly, huge response to inoculating with this organism in terms of the phenolic compounds that are produced. A second theme in the literature that we've identified, and I don't know that this is really truly distinct from the earlier one. Clearly, organisms are involved in nutrient cycling. However, there's a separate body of literature looking at the effect of nutrient concentration and nutrient availability in the soils and that the relationship to plant growth and secondary compound production. This work was really a lot of work done in forest systems, plant physiologists working in natural systems. And two reviews here, Kurachiva in 1998 and Stamp in 2003, but more recently an interest in agricultural by agricultural scientists that this sort of thing could be going on in our systems as well, and that was reviewed by Brandt et al. In 2011. And this is some data from a paper published in 2007 that really put this idea on the map for me. Alison Mitchell looked at the concentration of flavonoids in tomatoes grown in organic and conventional farming systems here in California. And the really unique thing about this paper was that she looked at the concentration of flavonoids in the two farming systems over time. And so here on the y-axis we have the concentration of flavonoids in the tomatoes, and the gold bars are the conventional and the organic is the purple. And you can see that while the concentration in the conventional tomatoes remains constant over time, that in the organic tomatoes increases over time. And there was a negative relationship between this increase in flavonoids in the organic tomatoes and the decrease in inputs, nitrogen inputs, into that system over time. And why were they decreasing inputs into the organic system? Well, presumably because soil health was improving and the need for inputs was reduced. So again, you know, whether these are nutritional effects or more plant response to the changing microbial communities, we don't know, but it's still an interesting response there. Finally, I would just like to talk a little bit about organic farming as a case study. There are multiple meta-analysis and review papers in the literature asking this question whether organic foods are healthier than conventional foods, and highly controversial topic. But I would like to highlight this recent paper, which is, I think, the most comprehensive meta-analysis on this topic to date. And one point they made is that some of the earlier meta-analyses restricted the data to certified farm operation comparisons, right? And so all these experiment station comparisons that we've been conducting were purposefully excluded from these reviews on the purpose that they weren't certified. But Baranski et al. Said the point, well, you know, it's management that's going to influence the outcome, not certification. And so this was really based on a much larger data set than some of these earlier review papers. And so in this one here, I've just tried to summarize this for you. What they report are the mean percent differences on a scale between 100% and a negative 100%, right? So if it's a positive direction, the differences are higher in organic foods. If it's negative, the differences are lower in organic foods. And for and this is just a short list of some of them, different classes of secondary compounds were all higher in these organic foods. While cadmium was significantly lower, interestingly, there were few differences in mineral nutrient concentrations. And I think we are seeing this again and again, that while consumers perhaps believe that there's higher nutritional content, that is the less robust claim. The real difference that's starting to emerge are these differences in secondary compounds. So finally, this is my final slide, I want to just briefly address this question, well, do these secondary compounds influence human health? I'm not a health specialist, so this is just a little bit of a brief taste of what I'm aware of. These are traditionally seen as anti-nutrients, right? Grazing specialists have known for a long, long time that secondary compounds, tannins and such, can reduce intake of forages by ruminants. And so, historically, these have been viewed as bad, right? And there's still many people who see it that way today. However, there is growing evidence, I think, quite recently, that these may have interesting interactions with our own gut flora and, as a result, human health. So now we're talking not of just about the plant microbiome, but the human microbiome, right? And there appears to be interesting interactions that may be going on between our own gut flora, what we eat, and then our health. And there's been a number of interesting mechanisms that have been shown: immune system effects, anti-carcinogenic effects, antioxidant effects, anti-inflammatory effects, and sort of modulatory effects on our own gut, the composition, species composition of our own gut flora. So I want to recognize, though, that this is still very controversial. The review by Smith Spangler et al. In 2012 at the bottom got a lot of attention in the media. They really did not touch on this. You know, their own results showed a highly significant difference in secondary compounds between organic and conventional produce. But they dismissed that for two reasons, saying, first of all, these aren't nutrients. And secondly, we don't know enough about their effects on human health to be able to really make any claims about them at this point. We need more research, and this is a growing topic of interest. So just to summarize, I think we might agree that there are well-established links between soil health, environmental quality, plant productivity, and human health, and growing evidence for linkages between soil health, food crop health, and human health. These, you know, examples of these links are the possibility for nutrient-dense foods resulting from nutrient-dense soils and plant-microbial interactions, as well as soil fertility-plant interactions. And finally, you know, and John Duran, even in the early 90s, raised this question, how do we manage the soil microbiome and our own microbiome to really optimize these effects? Because if there's any, it's relatively easy to demonstrate these in controlled conditions in the laboratory, but as soon as you go out into the field, it gets much more complicated, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't, and we just do not really understand yet why that is. So with that, I'd like to take any questions at this time.
I think we have time for one question if we can. Well, here we have a question.
Okay, yes. Right.
But you also have less yield.
Yeah.
So how do you balance?
That's an excellent question, and I think that is something that we need to address going forward. There have been suggestions that it's the timing of the nutrient release that might affect secondary compounds. And so if you have a slow release fertilizer with a more steady uptake, that then you can have the secondary compound production and high yield. But again, that's only, I think, a suggestion. And then there's the question of breeding, really, you know, selecting plants for nutrient density particularly and high yield at the same time. And as Murphy suggested, these two traits may not be necessarily directly linked. We may be able to get both. But I think this is really research needs for the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much.